Yes, could you tell your name and where you're from?
Allie Hees, and I'm from Attleboro. As China becomes more Americanized, what does that do to its culture and tradition?
Crystal, and then Howard.
I think there's a lot of conflicts internally, if you look at the teenagers, and about the conflicts between Americanized culture and Chinese traditional culture. And this is how you will see Starbucks at at Great Wall and Forbidden City, where people think drinking coffee more than tea nowadays, or having more fast food from America than Chinese food. So that's the conflicts. But if you look at, again here, if you look at what happened to the younger people, if you look at their reaction to the major catastrophes like the earthquake in southwest of China, they all behave unitedly towards the attacks, towards the disaster, towards to anything that needs them support. So I think there are conflicts, no doubt, because of the globalized economy. Nobody, they're on Facebook. They are doing anything that we're doing here in this country. So actually, I did a study a few years ago. I look at the younger people between China, Japan, and Korea. There are more similarities than differences between the three countries. Although, China is a big country. It's not homogeneous in itself.
I would just say very quickly, I don't accept the premise of the question. I don't believe that Chinese youth are becoming Americanized.
Go ahead, William, and then Bob.
I agree with Howard. China has imported what they see as best practice from all over the world, and they're comfortable with that. But it doesn't change them into, it doesn't change their fundamental identity. One of the important things about China is it's like the United States. China is a very diverse society. There are many kinds of Chinese. They're speaking many different dialects with many different customs. And throughout Chinese history, they've imported whatever worked. Today, Americans serve as directors of the biggest Chinese banks. In the past, Matteo Ricci, Jesuit priest, got a very high position in dynastic government. But what the people see is the essence of Chinese remains. You have this explosion of wonderful art that's a mixture of traditional Chinese and Western. It's not an abandonment. It's different from Japan, which opens up when it's in trouble and then backs off and shuts down. The Chinese way works.
Bob.
We really need to think about what it means to become Americanized or Sinified. For example, 36,000 Chinese restaurants in the United States, more Chinese restaurants than Wendy's, McDonald's, and Burger King combined. So does that make us more Chinese? I think not, actually. I think we're comfortable eating Chinese food and still being Americans, right? Not to mention all that drywall and all the stuff that's from China that we don't actually think of as Chinese. But we do, in fact, consume a lot of China and a lot of Chinese products and so
there's a saying, may I add? There's a saying, once a Chinese, always Chinese. I think that still holds today.
Howard French.
I just wanted to say, I gave a too quick answer, I think, to the question about Americanization. China is obviously a very big country. It's the largest population in the world. It is geographically roughly the same size, a little bit bigger than the United States. This means these factors, plus several others, which I could mention, like the longevity of its history, like the very careful central control exerted over culture and over education, mean that all contribute to this extraordinary center of gravity that exists, culturally speaking, in the country. Chinese identity or Chinese, a notion, an integrity of Chinese culture is not even going to be chipped away in the slightest by the existence of Starbucks or by McDonald's.
And let's talk about this concept of China-America, which is the fusion, economic fusion of these two countries and what it implies in geopolitical terms as well as economic terms. Crystal Zhang, you have a good sense of exactly how connected our economies are at this point. Could you give us some statistics with that?
Okay, I think I'm a big person on hard data. I think look at in the past 27 years, Sino-US trade volume has increased 80 times, so which is means from 2.5 billion in 79 to 121 billion in 2005. So this is one factor. If you look at FDI from US companies, there are over 55,000 companies in China, and a recent study by Chamber of Commerce in United States reported 70% of them are profitable, and over those companies, 42% reported higher profit margin in China than any other foreign countries in the world. So if you look at the two countries, economically speaking, we're highly integrated in a broader sense in terms of financial capital flows, in terms of knowledge spillover, in terms of people, mobility. So this has been a big factor into play.
William Overholt, how are they connected economically? How much reserve of American currency do they hold now in China? And how did they get that kind of money? What are these free enterprise zones that began in Shenzhen and have seemed to go up and up the southeast coast of China? And how have they attracted capital?
Well, I'd start with the fact that we have a cultural image of, you know, where these terrible economic competitors going head to head. And obviously, what has brought the two countries together is mutual advantage. That we're a service economy, they are a manufacturing economy. They are savers, we are spenders. They have been extraordinarily welcoming of our foreign investments, so that, as Crystal said, our companies in China are just much more profitable than they are in Japan or Korea or our other allies, our other capitalist, allegedly capitalist allies. Because they save a great deal, because they don't have adequate education or medical care or pensions as a poor country, so they have to save for contingencies. And because we don't, there's this symbiotic relationship, and they end up with a lot of money. It's about $2 trillion at the moment in their foreign exchange reserves. That puts them in a very weak position. It's a terrible position to be in. We think that means they're powerful. They have power over us. No, it means that no matter what they do, they lose money.
Well, it means we're in the same boat, doesn't it, beyond anything else? And in fact, in this middle of the recession, there was number three there, Jim, a quote by a minister, I think, of finance in China. Could you play that one, please?
We're actually in the same big boat that has been hit by fierce wind and huge waves. With our interests interconnected, sharing will and woe, and what we can do is to follow the trends of the development of our times, try to cross the stormy water together as passengers of this boat to seek harmonious coexistence and women cooperation.
Howard French.
That's a great passage you played. I mean, I think perspective and balance is needed, and that what Bill said about what the implications of them holding $2 trillion of our debt means is not necessarily to their advantage. I mean, that's all perfectly well put. The question that relates to this passage, though, is, okay, so we're traversing this sea against high winds and waves and all the rest. What's on the other side of the sea? We need to follow the trend and get to the other side together. The big unanswered question, and I don't have the answer, but I think everyone should be wondering about this, is so what if we get to the other shore safely, what's there for us? You know, how are the situations of these two countries and of the world economy in general going to be transformed by this trend that he says we should follow?
Bob Lee, can you help us out here?
That strikes me as a comparison to the Nixon moment is the sense that American leadership is going to have a similar sense of moment and a similar sense of flexibility. Because it seems to me that as we come out of the global financial crisis, there will be a different set of relationships between China and the United States around economic and trade issues. China's position will be different. We don't know exactly how. And the United States will be different. And it depends a little bit on how quickly both of these countries or either of these countries come out of that recession and the positions that they have. I mean, if we think now about China being the the largest trading partner, not only with Taiwan and South Korea, but with Japan now, and Brazil, and many other countries, the EU and so forth, so that as we come through this period, China will have a different economic position, if not to say, and one assumes that a different set of political options available to it.
But doesn't that also mean that there's going to be a difference in the way that Americans look at themselves down the road? If indeed they are actually now sharing this, and I, for lack of a better term, an economic limelight, if they are no longer the king on the hill, if they are no longer the leaders in the world economically and yet serve its, as its sort of military leadership, doesn't that begin to presage perhaps a real change in the American view of itself and possibly a dangerous change?
My sense is that is the crisis. There is a sense right now, a kind of free-floating anxiety about China. It's in the food, it's in the drywall, it's in all of those, it's in the debt question. We don't quite know, Americans don't kind of quite know what's going to happen next. And I think that there's this kind of free-floating anxiety in which China is out there as we don't know quite what.
Howard?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't disagree with you, Bob, but I think there are some things that we do know, more or less. And we do know, more or less, that if current trends, even very roughly, continue, then China in the foreseeable future will be the world's largest economy. The question, the interesting questions get to, have to do with sort of, so what does this really mean? And I think, one of all sorts of kinds of complexity arise from these new realities. China will, in 20 or some 30 years, depending on the forecast, be the world's largest economy. But it's still going to be a country that, in GDP terms, is per capita GDP terms far, far less rich than the main leading rich countries of today. So how does China is spreading its interests as well it should be in every part of the world, Africa, in Latin America, and taking on roles of great influence that are displacing traditional partners like Europe in the case of Africa or the United States in the case of certain Latin American markets. How does all of this play out? It's more than in the air. I mean, these are things that
we might be seeing a different model evolving. William and then Crystal, please.
We get into a panic when somebody else is becoming successful. But Howard asked, where's the shore that we're heading to? It's toward a relationship like the one we have with Europe and with Japan. We got into a terrible panic a generation ago when the Japanese were coming up. The question of whether there would be a war between us and Japan, or weren't the Japanese going to buy everything? And the Japanese had an undervalued currency and piling up these huge reserves. Weren't they going to be able to force us to do whatever they wanted us to do? And by looking back at the nonsense that so much of America, most of America, convinced of themselves about Japan's rise, we can see, if the other country becomes successful, we make better software and they make better cars. This is a world that works. It's not necessarily a world of terrible conflict. In fact, it's a lot less likely to be a world of terrible conflict.
Crystal Zhang.
I totally agree with William's comment. I think that's right. We should stop panicking. If you look at FDI from China in terms of foreign direct investment in the U.S., last year was only 4%. So if you look at the data, 50% goes to Hong Kong, 6% go to Africa. I don't know why we're talking about China buying United States and we're being attacked to start panic. 4% is so far less to be worried about. If you look at Japanese currency's appreciation. That's how history repeats, right? Look at in the 80s, Japanese yen was appreciated from 250 yen to a dollar to 120 yen to a dollar. Nothing had changed the U.S. economy. Not much happened in the 80s. So why we're so worried, also panicking about China's taking the world?
Bob. I'm not actually suggesting that China in any way kind of represents a threat. What I'm suggesting is that in the United States, in American society, as, for example, we have lost millions of manufacturing jobs, as Rhode Island's economy, Rhode Island's unemployment rate hits 13%, that those kinds of anxieties over our own economic situation then often get transferred to the other, right? That's the moment of anxiety, the kind of anxiety that I'm describing and concerned with. It's not in some ways at the level of elite policymakers. They, you know, they look at the numbers, they can figure out ways in which, you know, banks can survive this, right? But can working class Americans who have to deal with job loss, for example, the idea that their jobs might be going overseas, that's where huge and very real anxieties lie.
And in fact, there's historical precedences for these kinds of ways to locate and target your free-flowing anxieties, especially with China. There's an old and well-worn rutted path that way. Howard French?
You know, one of the questions you raised a few minutes ago, Mark, was, so, you know, how will Americans see this and deal with this? And, you know, our point here, I don't think any of our purposes here is to feed any irrational anxiety about China or, you know, to feed the notion of a China wanting to take over the world, to put it very crudely. China and Japan are very different entities. So you take these objective, you know, the sorts of data that Crystal Zhang likes to work with, and you begin to make certain projections based on these objective economic facts, which establish very real trends, such as the GDP trend that I talked about a moment ago. And then you attach to that certain other notions, which are not as objective, I grant you, but are important. China is a country of 1.3 billion people. We all know that, right? That has consequences. The Chinese nation is a nation that, in some ways, very similarly to the United States, is a nation of quite extraordinary cultural confidence and this very coherent sort of identity and sense of destiny. The very name China means center of the world. So, you know, Americans do, I think, have an interest in thinking about what's on the other side of the shore, as much in terms of why we were really silly in the 1980s with the hysteria over Japan, but also in terms of, even if hysteria is not warranted today, what is different about China in these extra statistical ways?
If you would, please, in 2 minutes, summarize what you feel the importance of President Nixon, Secretary Kissinger's trip to China was in 1972, and how do you think it brought about the world that we're in today? Bob Lee?
Well, it seemed to me that the trip itself stabilized a relationship that was perhaps at that particular moment in danger of real conflict. I'm not sure the trip itself in some ways, you know, accelerated or decelerated these economic policies that seem to have transformed Chinese society in the last 20 years, but they certainly didn't hurt it.
Bill Overholt.
It started a process of confidence building that made it possible a decade later for Deng Xiaoping to feel he could bet the future of China on the economic relationship with the United States. It's the relationship with the United States that's been ultimately the secret of China's rapid development. And second, it established a template for Chinese-American cooperation on the most sensitive, difficult security issues, regardless of a range of other fears and differences. At the time, it was cooperation over the Soviet Union. Today, when we have a global financial crisis, who are the countries that get together and deal with it decisively? The United States and China. The Europeans can't get their act together, nor can the Indians or the Japanese. We and the Chinese do it. North Korea, we and the Chinese get together and deal with it. Regional crime, drugs, freedom of trade, freedom of investment, genetically modified crops, on all the important issues in the Pacific and many in the globe, it's now a U.S.-Chinese partnership. Wouldn't have been possible without that generation of confidence building that started with Nixon and Mao.
Howard W. French.
I would agree with just about every word that was just said, which makes it harder to fill my 2 minutes, I guess. One thing that's really striking in this conversation is, you know, if you are not of a certain age, the term Soviet Union must sound very quaint. And I think the fact of the quaintness of the Soviet Union began with that meeting. That the very eclipse of the Soviet Union as a central factor in our lives stems from this diplomacy. And all of this, I would say, just final summation is getting back to what I said at the beginning, that about complexity and about unintended consequences, that anything that you read in the present-day news where statesmen are speaking with what sounds like great certainty about what their goals are and what the outcomes are and here's where we're headed and here's the roadmap, they don't have any idea, really. In fact, anything complex leads to vastly greater complexities down the road, and that's the ultimate lesson of this diplomacy.
Crystal Zhang.
I agree with everybody's comments. I think it's, again, here is a signal from the U.S. About the recognition of the China. And also from the Chinese point of view, is kind of the willingness to cooperate, to become friends with a foreign country far away, which is way different from China back then. Again, if you look at Chinese saying, there's Chinese saying talking about when a friend comes to visit you, would you be very happy to accept that? So China, again here, they're willing to make friends with any country that's willing to make a step ahead.
What began as a handshake and a few drinks of a very strong liquor is now a subtle dance where who's taking the lead is never really clear. Both need each other for the dance to continue. Both occasionally complain about each other's dance steps. Both sometimes scan the room for a more attractive partner. But both, China and the United States, know that each other's fates, indeed that of the world's economy, depends upon each other's health. The music plays, the dance continues, and a world is being created through their embrace. Our thanks to our panelists, Howard W. French, an associate professor at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. A former reporter for the New York Times, French has served as bureau chief for Central America and the Caribbean, West Africa, Japan and the Koreas, and Shanghai in China. Crystal Zhang, doctorate and assistant professor of management at Bryant University's Business College. Her research work appears in the Oxford Handbook of International Business, Journal of World Business, Asia Pacific Journal of Management, and other periodicals. And Dr. Robert George Lee, an associate professor of American Civilization and chair of the American Civilization Department at Brown University. Three of Lee's well-known books are Dear Mia, Letters Home from Japan, 1931 to 1946, Orientals, Asian Americans in Popular Culture, and Displacements and Diasporas, Asians in the Americas. And Dr. William H. Overholt, a senior research fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He formerly held the Asia Policy Research Chair at RAND's Center for Asia Pacific Policy and served as directors of the center. His recent work includes America and Asia, The Coming Transformation of Asian Geopolitics, and the award-winning The Rise of China.